Pandora Levan is. Pandora was one of the secretaries, lovely girl, couldn't be there. And so, but John pretended that they had both eloped and that they were living up in Queensland. So sent a message that they, you know, were. And anyway, there were lots of laughs, lots of drinks, lots of cigars. Sandy was a cigar man. I wasn't a big cigar man, but I didn't mind the occasional cigar. And I better not say the source of the cigars, but occasionally there would be some official gifts, you know, which were just extremely high quality tobacco, which would come through. So that was very nice.
What was your relationship like with the Prime Minister's personal secretary, Jean Sinclair?
Oh, Jean.
I believe she had played a very important part in a role in the office.
Yeah. Very sad because, of course, she died pretty well at that time. She would have died in, I guess, the early 91, something like that.
There's actually
of cancer.
Before we go on that, there's actually a picture of you with Graham Frydenberg, Dorothy Scurry and Jean Sinclair taken in April of 1991. And I was going to ask you, what was the occasion for that? There's a picture just outside the office, what used to be the old
April,
office.
Yeah. Actually, April 1991, 8 years. So that was the 8th anniversary of Hawke's election as Prime Minister, which I think put him ahead of Fraser in terms of duration as Prime Minister. And so he became the second longest serving Prime Minister after Menzies, obviously. And so we had a drinks party. And I think that's what that event is. Why I remember that, I don't know. But April 91 is the giveaway. Okay, so Jean must have got sick afterwards, after that. But she had cancer. I mean, she was a big smoker. But Jean, a hugely underestimated figure. Jean had been with Bob back in the ACTU days and continued to be. So she was his, I think the title was personal secretary. She was and continued to be his connection with the labour movement, with all of the unions, with all of the ACTU, with the Melbourne Jewish community, with and essentially with Bob's pre-prime ministerial political life, which was extensive, with all of the arbitration commission people. Jean, you know, knew them all. Kept in touch with them all, and you know, managed that part of his life. Continued to do it completely unflapped. A gorgeous, generous woman, Jean. When we moved into the new Parliament House, she ended up sharing an office with Freudy, not me. And I think it was because they both smoked. And you know, that was this kind of the proverbial smoke-filled room sometimes. What can I say? So sadly missed. She was so you know, generous and calm and you know, loved Bob but knew his faults as well, you know, was just such, you know, one of the pillars that kept that man you know, as the Prime Minister that he was. It's hard talking about these people, I must say. It's try to summarize for we're making a record here for the future, and I'm just aware of, you know, the inadequacies of what I'm saying. Actually, I'm certainly speaking from the heart, but I feel as though I must be missing bits. But anyway, she was a wonderful woman. We played tennis, by the way, not just here in the old Parliament House. We played tennis on the international trips as well. Famously, in our visit to India, we stayed in New Delhi at the, I believe it's called the Rashtrapati Bhavan, which was the kind of basically the foreign guest house for visiting leaders, which is this magnificent building right in the heart of teeming New Delhi, but surrounded by acres and acres of beautiful lawns, tropical gardens, and lawn tennis courts. And so the Australian party made it clear that they wouldn't mind to go on the lawn tennis courts. And we just thought that we would just, you know, kind of turn out. We had our rackets and our shoes, but I don't think we had much by way of official gear. And we certainly didn't expect that when we turned up to this tennis court, there was a staff waiting for us, dressed to the nines with the turbans and all. With the cool drinks. It was and remains the only time I've ever played with the services of a ball boy, in fact, in a whole set of ball boys. And as I served double fault after double fault, and this kid would roll the tennis balls over to me and say, "Never mind, sir." there was a couple of a couple of young Indian tennis players who were so damn good anyway. But it was just one of those bizarre, exotic experiences for an hour on an international trip.
Just briefly, you've spoken quite a lot about Graham Frydenberg and your relationship with him.
Mm.
Is there anything you want to add?
I should. Thank you. Yeah. Excellent. I was going to raise that. Graham was a bit of a family friend of my wife. I should say this. So my wife, Helen O'Neill's father, was a publisher, Lloyd O'Neill. And Lloyd had run Jacaranda Press, was his principal one, but there are other imprints. And Lloyd had published Arthur Calwell's two books, Be Just and Fear Not, and whatever the other one was called. And Freudy obviously had worked on those. In fact, I think, if there was a Trade Practices Act in those days, it shouldn't have Arthur Calwell's name on it. But anyway, so Freudy knew Lloyd, from back in the 60s. Helen can remember, Graham. Helen can remember all of these authors coming around to their home, to talk with her father about publishing. So Graham was such a gentleman. Our daughter was born. I joined the office in 86. Our daughter was born in May of 87, Janet, in Canberra. We were already living in Deakin at that stage, and the election was called, I guess, in July. So, I was basically off with the, with the political, event anyway, but at one point Graham came around to pay a visit to see our daughter, and he didn't realize until afterwards. So come around, have a cup of tea, here's the baby, and so forth. And it was only when he was leaving that he was standing on the front steps to leave that he lit up a cigarette, and we'd realized that he'd spent this entire time, this chain smoker, generously not smoking whilst in the presence of this baby, which was so nice of him. But I can remember, as the proud father, showing photographs of the newborn Janet in the Prime Minister's office, including to Kim Beazley, who came through. And, I think people are pretty soft and indulgent with new fathers. And Kim looked at this photograph and said, "Yeah, it's amazing. They all look like boiled chickens when they're born," isn't it? And handed the photo back. Rod Sims and I attended the 1989 grand final together. He's a Hawthorn fan. I'm a Geelong fan. It was possibly the greatest game of football ever played, and that was courtesy of Hawke. We certainly were able to travel to and from on the VIP, although I think we may have bought our own tickets, and we lost that grand final. But it's certainly softens the blow of it to fly back to Canberra in that style. You know, I sometimes used to think with this whole sporting thing that there was we were a parallel PMO, you know, and I can remember in the new Parliament House, there were some tradies came in, some doing some electrical wiring work, and they had the ladders up and the tools out. And meanwhile, there was some, I don't know, golf thing on the television, and people are gathered around watching it. And they were curious, you know, is this actually the Prime Minister's office? Because, but particularly with Bowen, but everybody was a bit sports mad, and, you know, we had time to multitask. But, you know, was there some other place where the actual Prime Minister's office existed and we were just the, you know, we were just the kind of actors doing it? Well, no, that's just how we did it. We had a great time.
Talking about going back to the press gallery and your times there, I think you spoke quite extensively about Michel Grattan in the early interviews. Were there any other journalists that stand out in your memory as people that from your experience working with them or others? In particular, for example, did you have any impressions of Alan Reid, who was still around at the time when you joined?
No.
Or Laurie Oakes?
Yes. Alan Reid, I wouldn't have. I think I saw him, but I mean, I don't. You know, would never have crossed his path or, you know, entered his consciousness, I'm sure. Mm. Oakes was certainly around and at the head of the Herald Sun bureau then. In fact, he was the one who hired Geoff Walsh into Canberra journalism at the Herald Sun. Now, did we talk about the non-members bail last time? I think we did, didn't we?
I was going to remind you about that. Yes, you did mention the confrontation between Oakes and Brian Toohey.
Yeah. The confrontation of the belly. Mm. Bellywood. Look, there were so many other journalists, and I still, you know, stay in touch with them, so it's a bit hard to single out individuals. I mean, there was Tom Mockridge at the Sydney Morning Herald, who's gone on to a very distinguished career as an executive in News Limited overseas in Italy and in the UK. Simon Ballaston. Okay, so Simon was a colleague of mine from The Age in Melbourne, and then we worked together in the Canberra Bureau here, and then he went back to Melbourne, or we both went back. I joined Hawke staff. He later joined Hawke staff as well. So kind of parallel careers for, you know, quite a while, and good mates. He stayed on. I think he was probably the only staffer who stayed on between Hawke and Keating, because he was across all of the environmental and Indigenous issues. And then went to SOCOG, and he's still involved in the IOC Olympic movement. Who else? Oh, I should say we did... you know, one person of note, Carol Thatcher, who is the daughter of the British Prime Minister. She came out in, I guess, the, you know, it might have been 1980 or something like that, to work in the Canberra Parliamentary Press Gallery. You know, obviously to get out of Britain and, you know, have a separate life, you know, apart from her, you know, mother being, you know, Prime Minister. So I think that was actually a good move. She was a funny person. She wasn't, I think she probably wasn't made for Canberra journalism, but she battled on very well, and she just had a great temperament. Liked to laugh, good fun. We went with her, I think I said when we were talking about it, we, you know, we would often go out at weekends, all of these young single people, and, you know, we'd go out to barbecues, Angle Crossing, and, you know, Majors Creek and stuff like that. And on one occasion, we went up to the Bong Bong races with Carol on board, drove up there. You know, Bong Bong, I mean, it's the only time that I've ever been there, and I hope those events are still going with as much fun and, you know, sense of exotic excitement. You know, those picnic races, they're magnificent events, and Carol certainly enjoyed that. I mean, it was a very far cry, I think, from home in London.
We run out of people to talk about.
Well, this, I mean, I can. I've run out of significant things to say about them, I guess.
Well, in that case, perhaps we could skip to something rather more substantial in some respect. You were still around and still on staff during the time when Paul Keating first challenged Bob Hawke in May, June of 1991. Could you talk a bit about that, and particularly from your perspective? And I suppose, with that, did you have any knowledge of the so-called Kirribilli Agreement?
Oh, God, no. Christ, no. No, that I can remember the thunderclap when it came out. No, certainly not. And that was the trigger for that whole night of the long night, which I mentioned I did write about in the book, kind of in terms of who, you know, who spoke to whom on that night that I saw. It was a very stressful period from a staff point of view, obviously, because you're not, you know, this is where the distinction between staff and, you know, actual members of caucus is nowhere starker, and that's very proper. You know, we were not part of any decision-making process that was going on, but obviously a lot hung on it, you know, our jobs and also our loyalties. It was very sad. I mean, I just wish that Keating hadn't dragged down a prime minister, because together Hawke and Keating were an absolutely devastatingly effective team, and they were better together than either of them were separately, in terms of policy and politics and overall devastating impact on any opposition leader who, you know, got within cooee. So that all came to an end, and with it, you know, a lot of things were fractured. I mean, I had good friends in Keating's office. I'm thinking, Tom Mockridge was in Keating's office, and John Edwards, Seamus Dawes. You know, they were all decent people, but you know, once this challenge was on, you know, you were separated from them. It was the proverbial brother against brother situation, and you know, just very, very sad, and obviously bad government. You cannot govern when you're tearing yourself apart.
How did this atmosphere and the events themselves direct impact on you, on you yourself, and the work you were doing? Did it change the way, you know, that things were done? Where, for example, was there a different emphasis in the speeches after that time, or before and after that time, because of a change of that? Bob Hawke might have changed his attitude to anything?
Look, I think honestly the answer is no, that I didn't see any. Clearly there was a lot going on in the government. Were they manifested in terms of my actual day-to-day job? Well, I certainly didn't feel, you know, we certainly didn't have these very good relations across the whole ministerial office. You know, I mean, as I say, you wouldn't go to Keating's office or Dawkins' office, you know, for a chat or, you know, for input. you know, it was us versus them. And, you know, I guess... but that said, we did do, right at the end, I think early 91, we did a big economic statement, which might have been called Building Competitive Australia, if my memory serves me right. And that was actually one of the highlights. That was a real, I thought it was a great document. I mean, so professionally, in terms of what I actually produced, what we produced, I thought was very good. But, you know, it was notwithstanding we've got this, you know, unbelievable fight going on, or not at that stage, notwithstanding the tensions and uncertainties between the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, this was still a good, substantial piece of politics and economic policy making, and it was a good process.
Can you remember your reaction to learning about that there was to be this challenge, what it was, and how did it come out of the blue as far as you were concerned?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there were obvious tensions, but the Kirribilli House thing, and then that, you know, night of the long meetings, leading to the challenge. Look, it was just like a, you know, it was a bolt from the blue. I couldn't believe that such a thing had been done, that Kirribilli House agreement. I certainly felt that, to the extent that it was an agreement between the two of them, and I could see how they'd structured it, so as with Kelty and Abels there as their kind of seconds, their witnesses, I could certainly see how, to the extent that there was an agreement, it no longer applied. It had been breached. And Hawke was under no obligation to step aside. I mean, Margaret, he was the Prime Minister. Why should he step aside? Why should he have been forced into making an agreement with a Treasurer who simply wanted his job, who hadn't demonstrated any Prime Ministerial attributes? In fact, in some respects...
Did your loyalty to the Prime Minister change at all when this challenge came
up? No, it hardened up. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, everybody... could you have worked for Hawke and been a Keating supporter? No. Impossible. You know, I mean, you would have... We mourned the fact that, you know, this was all happening. But in terms of what outcome did you want... In terms of who you saw being in the right and wrong, it was black and white.
So would you have been quite satisfied with the outcome of that first challenge?
Yes.
That it was rejected?
Yes, and Hawke having been, you know, successfully confirmed by caucus, you know, in that odd kind of two-stage process they had where there was a nod on, and then it was on. But anyway, Hawke having emerged victorious from that. And then there was a little uptick in the polls. Keating said he had just had the one shot in the locker and he went off to the back bench. And that's, I thought then, that's why it was a good time for me to leave the office. I thought that was an appropriate way to step out without sending any kind of signals that I was either unhappy from a challenge point of view, or more generally, that I was kind of abandoning Hawke in his hour of need, or, you know, anything like that. So I thought that was a good time to leave, you know, and so it proved, of course, Keating wasn't able to, you know, he had ants in his pants and needed to keep on keeping on. And, you know, I watched the next 6 months in which he dragged down the Prime Minister, you know, from the... luxurious immunity of the press gallery.
During your, I suppose this is going a bit more general again, during your time at Old Parliament House and later at the Australian Parliament, did you have much contact with ordinary members of Parliament, you know, non-ministerial members of Parliament? Okay. And were there any that stood out to you, for you in any shape or form, good or bad?
Occasionally, you know, I mean, the PM would make a visit to marginal electorates, and so, you know, we would always have, you know, a short, sharp, or short, intense, you know, relationship with that MP's office to organise the trip. But look, by and large, no. I can remember, you know, you had this enormous respect for some of these guys who held marginal seats. There was George Gear from WA who held his seat, George Gear, and there was another WA marginal. They were both very marginal, and they just held the seat, and then they held it again, you know, in 87, and then they held it again in 90. You know, they were just... George Gear was a really terrific local member. You could just see his, you know, kind of dynamic. I mean, loved the job. He kind of liked living on the knife edge, maybe. But he was very inventive in leveraging the power of the government, including the power of the Prime Minister, to draw attention to himself and his programs and his, you know, membership of, I think it was Stirling was the seat. Warren Snowden, I got to know a little bit, who's obviously still around as a minister in the current government. Lloyd O'Neill, not the name of my father-in-law, but another Lloyd O'Neill, amazingly enough, the member for, I think it was Grey in South Australia. We made an electorate visit there, and I accompanied the Prime Minister on that visit. You know, again, you just see this, you know, active, dynamic, kind of hardworking bloke who's covering this gigantic electorate and, you know, trying to, you know, promote things. Hawke shocked everybody by... We were staying in this tiny little motel, you know, little country motel, and Hawke emerged from the shower with the towel on, thank God, when Lloyd O'Neill and his wife were there in this tiny little room, and just proceeded to, you know, hello, how are you, and, you know, stuff like that. But he was completely unself-conscious, and it sounds, you know, I mean, it was funny.
Tell me, were there any parliamentarians that you came, I suppose, not to admire or not to respect for as members of parliament or as for their individual characteristics?
Well, I mean, the whole challenge thing, I mean, you know, I think Dawkins had been a brilliant minister, but I just thought that I lost a lot of respect for him when he started shilling for Keating. But you see, look, the answer is really no. And, you know, I mean, these were, what you did see were the ministers who were just so totally across their stuff. Button, Beazley, Evans, Dawkins, you know, not to mention Keating, you know, and I never had Mick Young, you know, I never had much of a contact with any of them except just sporadically, but occasionally you'd travel with them, or there'd be a meeting, or there'd be, you know, some joint speech, or you're working with their staff on something. And, you know, the whole thing was just full steam ahead. Everybody was motivated, the cabinet ministers, the ministers, but, you know, their staff. You know, we had very few, I can't think of really significant times when you just think, well, shit, what a dud, you know. It just wasn't like that. They were all absolutely, you know, guns in their different respects. Yeah.
And nothing, and you don't, do you believe that there were any changes from that perspective when after the first challenge, for example, did that lead to a change in the atmosphere?
Yes. You know, I mean, poor old John Kerin was made treasurer, and that didn't work out very well at all. And John Kerin had been an extraordinarily, you know, strong Minister for Primary Industries. And in fact, you know, when, you know, gosh, how are we going to replace Keating as Treasurer? Suggestion was made about Kerr, and everybody thought, oh, what a great idea, you know, because he's got that great natural style, and he knew his business. But so that didn't work. And then, you know, as I say, there was a chilling effect in terms of the relationships within at the staff level, which was all very sad.
Then thinking about the press gallery as in general terms, did you think the press gallery was generally fair and unbiased?
In relation to its reporting of the Hawke government?
Yes.
No, not really. But, you know, I'm probably in the worst possible position to make a judgment which itself would be unbiased. Put it this way, I don't think we got any free kicks out of them. You know, I don't think they were. You know, I mean, this was a reform government, so the core reform task, which I believe was so capably and in many respects brilliantly articulated by Hawke and by Keating. I give Keating 100% full respect for his communication skills in changing this Labour Party and changing the whole mindset about a protectionist, inward-looking economy, you know, where superannuation, you know, if you're a doctor, you could have superannuation or a barrister, but the idea of actually people, you know, working people having superannuation was, you know, was being introduced by this government. And the whole concept of the accord, which we talk about in the book, and the balance between wage restraint being imposed through, yes, a centralised wage fixation system, and on the other hand, the social wage, the Medicare, the superannuation, the way in which government was able to achieve outcomes in terms of wage restraint whilst actually improving the lot of ordinary working people through social wage increases, family allowance supplement being another one, which we talked about yesterday, was, I thought, just brilliant policy making and brilliant politics. And as I say, it seemed to be enormously difficult to explain that, and yet, you know, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer and the other ministers, you know, just constantly were at that task. Now, I don't think, you know, I think the journos got it. I mean, they saw what we were trying to do. They also saw the opposition had, like, absolutely nothing to offer, you know. I mean, bereft. So I don't think it was anything like the toxic anti-government, anti-Labour situation you've got now. But they, you know, I mean, there were just so many missed opportunities. So many times where I felt this big reform task was being hamstrung by a kind of, you know, nostalgic feeling that, oh gosh, change is a bit uneasy, and, you know, let's report the victims of change. You know, let's report how difficult this is. You know, let's report how screwed up it is. And, you know, so complex. Nothing near as bad. You know, I mean, I think Paul Kelly's End of Certainty, which was obviously not daily reporting, but, you know, I mean, I think there were some great journalists at the time, Kelly, Grattan, and I think their account is a fair, detailed, balanced, somewhat pro-Keating account. But, you know, I mean, I don't think the government has been badly done by in terms of the historical record by the press gallery. But at the time, it just seemed as though there was just so much, you know, it was an uphill battle every day. You know, you had John Pilger come in one day and do this interview, and it was just the most utter bilge, and, you know, it was self-promotion by him, you know, riding on the back of alleged concern for, you know, real Labor values. And, I mean, what he would know about it, I've got no idea. Anyway, Hawke walked out on that interview. So it was not a success in that regard either.
Then in 1993, you finally left the gallery, the press gallery.
Yeah.
And if you look back at your time both at Old Parliament House and at the Australian Parliament House, what would you think would be your fondest memory of your time here?
Oh, there are just so many. I did love working in this building, and I didn't like the new building very much. When we went into the new building, by the way, we had a tour. I'll answer the question, but we had a tour of the new building when it was still being fitted out. It was constructed, still being fitted out, and we had to... we were going to make the move kind of over a weekend. Obviously, business of government, we just had to keep on keeping on. I know some people continued to work in the Old Parliament House for a period of time, but we must have been up there on day one. But anyway, so we had a tour of the building, and I remember we were standing in the corridor outside the Prime Minister's suite, kind of with the cabinet room behind us, and there were the...